Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
Just when investors are fully convinced that their investment can't go wrong, and that can happen even in gold and silver, just when they're fully convinced that their thesis cannot be wrong is typically when it is wrong, because that's when it's easy to buy. The best investments are the ones that make you nervous to purchase them, quite frankly.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and I have back with me today Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management down in Georgia, where, Paul, I hear you've got some kind of a snowma icemageddon coming your way, potentially in the next few days. How you doing, buddy?
Absolutely. I'm doing good. If it's what they say that it's going to be quite interesting, because in the South, it can snow a half inch and it shuts down everything anyway. Mm-hmm. If we get an inch of ice plus another 6 inches or more of snow of what they're saying, it's going to be gridlock here for a while in the South.
Yeah, I lived in North Carolina 9 years. We called them bread alerts. So if there was a half inch of snow, that would be a one bread alert. If it was 2 inches of snow, that'd be like three bread. Because people go to the store and they just clean the bread aisle out. I don't know what Southerners are expecting, but it was a mystery to me because it was always the bread aisle just got cleaned out.
In the milk. All those grilled cheese sandwiches.
I guess.
Grilled cheese sandwiches and bologna sandwiches is what it is.
Yep. Well, I think this is an apt metaphor, though, Paul, for what I think is coming as well in the financial sphere. We've got a lot of warning signs. You and I have been talking about the crack-up boom, about what gold and silver, what the signals they're possibly sending us. Trump, Team Trump is doing all kinds of very, let's say, perturbing, shaking up of the world economic order. Lots going on, and I want to talk about it, Paul. I'm getting a lot of calls lately from people I know who are asking basically some version of this. How close are we to a fiscal and or a monetary accident? So a fiscal accident is the government spends more than it can take in and it can't find a way to pay for the things it wants. And I think we'll talk about Japan in the context of that. But could it be a monetary accident? Is that what we're seeing? So I kind of wanted to talk about that. And, you know, what's our evidence? Oh, I have to take myself out of the picture because, woo, look at that gold. As you and I have discussed a lot, the Biden administration did something really foolish in 2022, weaponizing the dollar. I think that's going to go down as one of the dumbest decisions ever made by an empire. But it'll take the historians to sort of untangle that. But, it you know, after that sort of digesting that news, we're here. And this is signaling something really potent to me now that can't be explained by, gold is a good inflation hedge or silver.
Right.
Silver is about to bend time if it goes up any more steeply, right? Chart's going to go backwards.
Yeah.
We'll find ourselves in 2024. Look at this. This is astonishing. And so these are clearly saying there's something out there that's concerning big money. That's what I'm seeing here.
I am too. And, you know, and so many times the most impactful events, you don't recognize initially. You know, I mean, we've talked about it many times about the lack of trust. And if we see what's taking place right now, the weaponization of the SWIFT banking system with the Biden administration, Trump actually started it back in his first term against Russia, but weaponizing that on the dollar only has trust, right? And America, from what we're hearing other countries say, is not a trustworthy nation anymore. And I think that's one of the reasons why you're seeing that move in gold. This is more than just an inflation hedge at this point. And especially with silver, other metals starting to move, copper starting to line up again, it looks like it's signaling a monetary event. The question is, how quick? Is this a birth pain towards that monetary event and people are positioning and we get a reprieve for a period of time? Or are we off to the races at this point? We're not going to know until we have the benefit of hindsight.
Yep. Well, let me... So there's a number of things that could be happening here. I want to just throw this on the table. And this is so yesterday because gold's now at 48.50. I pulled this down yesterday for today, but already out of date. But the point here is the quote from Grok saying President Trump announced tariffs starting at 10% on February 1st against eight European nations, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, France, Germany, and the UK, Netherlands, Finland, rising to 25% by June 1st, unless or until they agree to sell Greenland outright to the U.S. For reasons, Arctic security needs, they're saying. And Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent speaking in Davos, which is going on this week, always my favorite time of the year. Love what those team elite tells me I have to do this year. Called for calm, dismissed retaliation fears. He didn't just dismiss retaliation fears. I don't know if you caught this. This I found pretty astonishing for how dismissive it was.
Just to follow on to that, so you do not believe that the EU or the UK have any retaliatory financial instruments or measures in their bag that the United States should be worried about?
No.
No.
I did not see that.
Look at that.
No.
No.
No. Anything at all that that Europe could do? Anything at all? No.
No.
It's pretty dismissive, and of course, this is adding, I mentioned that perturbance or the realignment of the global order, but this is the United States throwing the gauntlet down saying, Europe, you're irrelevant to us. We don't care.
That smirk was quite interesting. He stopped himself short of laughing. No, there's nothing they can do.
I thought so, too. Did you see that? Yeah. It's a very dismissive smirk.
What are you worried about?
No.
Just to follow on to that, so you do not believe that the EU, they should be worried about?
No.
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 That's a lot of confidence.
I think what's happening in Japan, which is exploding yields. We'll talk about that in a second. I think it's signaling that we're at the tail end of the fiat experiment, kicked off August 15th, 1971, we could say, or wherever you want to sort of park that. But that's when the gold standard was temporarily suspended by Nixon. And since that point in time, we've had just this explosive growth in debts across all those fiat currencies because didn't matter. Japan maybe is going to show that it does matter. And then we have the swift weaponization. And then we have this, which is China's holding of golds is now much higher than treasuries. And two things about this. First, China's lying about how much gold they have. They have more. I guarantee it.
Right.
I'm positive.
Yeah.
Two, they haven't just sort of been like holding fewer treasuries, but they've sort of been like sliding down for a long time, many, many years. But we know that China has a trade surplus with the world of about $1.1 trillion, and half of that is U.S.-ish, something like that. What are they doing with all their, when they get these trade surplus dollars? What do you do with them? Where are they?
Looks to me like it's being recycled back into gold and commodities at the expense of treasuries. And notice there, Chris, when did that peak and start dropping? In 2009, it looks like on that chart, right?
Yep.
2008, 2009.
Yep.
That was the point that they fully understand that the U.S. would just print ourselves into oblivion. And it looks like that was the turning point going back where they have methodically started reducing positions and going into assets that could not be printed.
Yeah. And it's really picked up steam here, I would say, from 2022, which is right here.
Mm-hmm.
You can see it was kind of going at this rate, and then it bends down and goes faster again, because I think they got the message. Message was, hey, you can't trust us. So back to this whole idea. We didn't just seize Russia's sovereign reserves. The SWIFT system attacked what we call them oligarchs. We call them billionaires on this side, but the Russian oligarchs. They seized the private property, including with Europe's help, the private property of private citizens under the theory that this would put pressure on Putin to do something different. But they didn't just take Russia's sovereign reserves. They went after private individuals. They stole, seized, whatever you want to call them, commandeered, pirated yachts, planes, bank accounts, properties, private properties of Russians, right? And so the whole cornerstone of the Western experiment is supposed to be private property rights. Yeah? That's supposed to be a thing?
Right.
Guess they're not, when you start seizing private property, but say it's only because they are Russian oligarchs, you're kind of blurring something that I think you got to be crystal clear about what just happened. which I think the rest of the world interpreted. And I think they said, oh.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, why would you want to own those assets if you're a foreign citizen? Because, look, we're supposed to be trustworthy and we're supposed to have the integrity of the world, right? We're supposed to also have the rule of law. So the rule of law means that you're innocent until proven guilty. How many of them went to court? No. Their assets were seized, and what repercussion do they have? Even if they do try to go to courts, and I don't know that they have, what's the game that the government can play and attorneys stretch it out for as long as possible? Yeah, we'll supposedly get, you know, go through the due process. So this is just exercising power without regard for integrity and rule of law that made us trustworthy to deal with. That's how we solidified our position as a global reserve currency and why those countries were willing to invest into our currencies, but not anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to go into self-preservation mode as a fiduciary of the leaders of those countries for their citizenry. And they've been smart about it slowly, and it's continuing to pick up steam instead of, you know, just one event where they dump all the treasuries. They've been smart about this. While silver and gold prices have been low, oil prices, I mean, from everything that I've read, they've accumulated massive amounts of commodities and natural resources and stockpiled it with the surplus that they have, while we're just, you know, accumulating massive amounts of debt on depreciating assets or assets that don't even give us a return from a long-term standpoint.
So this is such an important point because global capital goes to wherever it's treated best, right? And it confused me. A number of years ago, a good friend of mine was working out of Singapore, and I'm like, why are you working out of Singapore? And she works with family offices, and this is where family offices were going. They used to all be in London and New York. I'm like, are these Asian families? She's like, oh, no. You know, these are European and American families. Why are they in Singapore? Because they had judged that they're going to get better, more fair treatment or more predictable treatment under the Singaporean law system than they were in the UK or in the US. Okay. It's hard to convey this, Paul, how much advantage we get as the United States because we have these deep financial markets that the world trusts or trusted and use. And once that goes away, we're going to find out that we didn't hit a triple. We were kind of born on third base, you know, and wish we could get that back. But it's so hard to get these things back. That's why I hated the silver manipulation and their little paper games and naked shorting and selling stuff they don't have. Because to me, that's fraudulent. Like if I go on eBay, Paul, and sell you a Maserati I don't own, that's a fraud. I'm going to jail, right? Rightly so. But if I get SEC approval, I can naked short like GME till, you know, comes out my pores. Anyway, point being, I'm worried that we don't have anybody in charge right now who understands that we have a golden goose and it would be really good. It would be better for all of us if we didn't kill it.
Absolutely. Well said. And it takes decades to destroy that trust, and I would say centuries to rebuild it.
Yeah. Yep. Well, this is why I think this is one of the most seismic things, and I think we'll get to the Japan stuff pretty soon. But Paul, we're gonna take a quick break. But when we come back, I think probably the most seismic chart we've got to talk about here because it really the game has changed, and I need people to understand the game has changed. And let's see what we can do. Okay, we'll be right back. Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions. All right, welcome back, everybody. Paul, I want to talk about this, which is continuation. This is astonishing. So the dollar had what was called a reserve currency status, meaning every central bank, every country wanted to hold dollars in reserve. There's a whole petrodollar oil story hidden in that story. But this is pretty astonishing here. So what we see here in the black line, this is the USD's role in global reserves. You know, it'd been hanging out here since 2006, basically at the 55% level for a while. But after 2022, notice what's happening here. It goes from just crunching along or just above 50 all the way down to 40. Bada boom, right? And then you got euros down here in the gold, and you got yen, which we'll see in the pound, but this is gold, right? This is clearly a flight away from all Western currencies into gold. And that, again, mirrors everything we've talked about with BRICS, the unit, all of this and that. But this actually represents a profound loss of trust. And by the way, trust, as you mentioned, it's the most important thing in a financial market. I'm worried that we have people who are busy wrecking trust.
And that goes back to 2022. You know, did you see the acceleration in the chart back in 2022, which is when the Ukraine war and broke out in Russia? And that's when, if I remember correctly, that's when they seized the assets of the oligarchs and they seized the assets from Russia. And that's the event. You know, you can build a lifetime. I was having a conversation with the kids and the family the other day. You can have a lifetime of building and earning trust and destroy it in one decision.
Yep.
And that's exactly what it looks like occurred. Like, it was deteriorating going back to 2015, but then all of a sudden it's accelerated. And it looks like it's continuing to accelerate. And with, you know, if the Japanese yen destroys yields and what's going on in Japan, then that's probably something else that's going to force an acceleration depending upon the U.S. response.
Yep.
Which, from what they're saying, is yield curve control. Isn't that what Bessent told them they needed to do? And I know we'll get to that in a minute, but I do think it's relevant.
Yeah. And well, so yield curve control, just to explain that real quick for people, is there's something called a yield curve. And that is that you're going to have different rates of interest for each one of these different products out there. A 3-month treasury bill is going to have a different rate of interest from a 6-month, from a year, a 2-year piece of paper, something that matures in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years. And so if you traced out the curve across each of those little data points showing what the rate of interest is, there'll be a curve of some kind. There'll be a shape. So that's the yield curve. Yield curve control is saying, hey, we don't like that number out there at the 10-year mark. Right. We want that lower. We're going to control that. Well, how do you control that? Well, you print up a lot of money and you buy a lot of 10-year paper. But it basically, yield curve control is a fancy way of saying printing money to buy up a stated maturity of outstanding debt. That's how I understand it.
Well, it is. So you should be compensated more for 30-year, for lending your money out for 30 years than what you would be for 3 months. That's why that curve goes up. But if they're printing money, that's not allowing the free market, that's not allowing investors to choose. You know, they're artificially desiring to control the longer end to mask what the bond vigilantes are refusing to do, right? The bond market should be able to go out and say, hey, this is the rate that I should get for 30 years. I'm willing to lend money at that area. But my concern is it reaches a point to where, well, what happens when all of a sudden you don't have any investors that are willing to lend at that 20 and 30 year mark, and it's strictly the government that's on the other side? That's when we hit the end of the monetary regime and we have a monetary fiscal, monetary accident on the other side of that.
Yeah.
Because something has to give if you're going to control that.
Well, we already know what's giving, because this week alone, the Federal Reserve is printing $53 billion out of thin air to buy up stuff. And we know they have to, because, Paul, we presented this last time. The first 3 months of the fiscal year for the United States government, which is October, November, December, they spent $602 billion they didn't have. That's a big pile of change. So that $602 billion had to go out into the bond market and get bought by people. Where did all that money come from, right? And if you have all that money is being vacuumed up by U.S. bonds. $600 billion is a huge number, by the way. Where's it come from? Well, I think that explains in part why the Fed is printing again, because there aren't enough buyers for that stuff. And let's go into the Japan story, because we're going to have to talk about how the bond market is maybe signaling exactly what you say. It's like hitting saturation. It's indigestion. It's hitting a level of can't do this. So we just saw that, and I know you have chart, maybe you could pull it up in a second, of Japanese bond yields spiking. Here's why. Excuse me. Prime Minister Takeuchi announced she's going to dissolve parliament on January 23rd, so a couple days from now, for a February 8th election, pledging to suspend the 8% food consumption tax. So food's getting expensive, inflation is hitting, so they're going to suspend that. So that's more government revenue that's not coming in. They're going to ramp up spending on jobs, so that's more government spending going out the door on jobs, households, and defense. So they're going to take in less money and spend more. So obviously that's going to pressure bonds in a big, big way. So boom, that's what we started to see. And I think that's been sending some shockwaves around markets here for the past week or so.
It has. Oh, it was interesting. So I came home the other night and my wife's gotten to where, especially with the weather, she's going to watch the evening news. So I was just curious because I don't watch the news. If I don't pay for the research or somebody like you that I trust, I just don't watch the news. Too much propaganda.
Yeah.
So we're sitting there, and of course they're like, oh, the markets have some volatility because of Trump's stance on Greenland. And I have learned, so I don't upset Holly, instead of yelling at the TV, I'm like, honey, it's not about Greenland. It's about the Japanese tenure right now. It's what's going on in Japan, right? And then Besant comes out and talks about it later. And I don't have a chart with me handy without going through and pulling it up. Do you happen to have a chart of the yields in Japan right now that's easily accessed? I've got U.S. Rates.
Yeah, I have a couple. I have one from 2 days ago, and it still kind of looks like this. But this was the shock market that happened. Let me get rid of this. So we see here, this is the whole yield curve we just discussed, from Japanese 1 month paper, 3, 6, 9 month, 1 year, all the way up to 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 year paper here on the bottom. And this is the percent change. This is the change in yield percent. And this is the actual percent change that represents. So we see here the Japanese 30 year was, previously it was at 3.602, and it jumped all the way to 3.88. whopping 0.28, 28 basis points, representing a 7.8% increase in the yield.
Massive.
This is penny stock behavior. This is not the long-dated paper of a major sovereign. This is an astonishing move that happened right here. So this is just on a one-day basis. You're like, whoa, what's that? But when you put it in and look at, this is their 10-year paper, ouch. You can clearly see that something is now out of hand in this story, because it looks like a silver chart, you know, but
it does.
Yeah. It's not always the destination, but it's the pace of change that gets you, right? So it's fine to walk from the top to the bottom of the Empire State Building. It's terrible to fall out and hit the sidewalk. So the pace of change here, this is really sending shockwaves, and it should. And by the way, at 2.27%, I've heard that if Japan's average weighted interest rate is 2% or more than 100% of known tax revenues are consumed just paying the interest.
Wow.
That's when you get into what's called the runaway debt spiral, where you have to borrow to pay interest, and you have to borrow to pay interest, and you have to borrow more to pay the interest on that interest, and you have to borrow more, and on it goes. So they're very close to what we would call a breakaway debt spiral, or death spiral, if you think of it that way. That's what's at hand right now. It's pretty bad.
And also the yen carry trade, right? I mean, that's something that huge institutions undertake. And yeah, it's great if you're borrowing money over there and in the U.S. and the Japanese yen has fallen towards the U.S. dollar, but it's a cash flow issue. So if you're getting up to where you're having these higher interest rates on the yen carry trade, I don't even know that I understand or anybody understands. There's people like Albert Edwards and some of the others that are trying to explain it, and you're trying to do a good job of explaining it as well. But the magnitude of liquidity that has been generated for the U.S. markets, for global capital, on that yen carry trade, where you could borrow money over there at 0%, you know, buy treasuries over here, use those treasuries for collateral somewhere else. I mean, this is a foundation that we've had for the U.S. markets for what, 20, 30 years now, that yen carry trade has provided a floor essentially of liquidity for easy money and lending. And we're starting to see that change across the board. If that yen carry trade is, if we've shifted from a regime, that's a lot less liquidity for the U.S. markets. And look, for the past 10 years, everybody's been arguing liquidity is what's causing the markets to go higher. That nobody talks about fundamentals anymore. You can't talk about fundamentals because the market's too expensive unless you want to talk about the downside risk. So they talk about liquidity. And what we're seeing, especially when you go look at in the U.S., especially those moves here over the past week, seem to be rippling into the U.S. markets. And I wanted to share interest rates. So this is end of day, so this is as of yesterday. Right up here, you can see since October, this is around the middle of October of 2025, mm-hmm. in spite of the Fed talking about cutting interest rates, yields started going higher. So the black line is the 30-year. It's bounced up to 4.2. The 20-year has bounced up, and look at the 10-year. I mean, that's a breakout. Like, I've got another chart that I'll show here in a minute. I'll stop sharing so you don't have to see me scroll through. But it's similar to the big breakout that occurred in gold several years ago, the silver breakout that occurred back in March of 25. I mean, this is a major breakthrough. So that looks like, and even on the shorter term, so this is your, right here, the orange is your 5-year U.S. Treasury and green is your 3-year. So all of these are starting to spike across the board. So it looks like that lack of liquidity and that ending yen carry trade is starting to have ripple effects into the U.S. Treasury market. And that's one thing that Besant was talking about as well.
Yeah, and for people who thought that looked like a bunch of squiggly lines, it did. But what should be happening there, when the Fed says they're going to start cutting rates, it means that interest rates are coming down, so basically it should come down everywhere in the interest universe, because it means that, you know, the paper is getting more expensive, the yields are going down, right? So that's the seesaw. But for the Fed to say, oh, we're going to start cutting rates, and for the long end to say, oh, yeah, well, we're going the other way, right, is bizarre. And then I just want to dial in on just this one, the 30-year paper. This, when I showed that look, there was that big spike in Japan, this is what our U.S. 30 paper did at the same moment. It also spiked, right? And that's not supposed to happen. And so that raises this other idea, Paul, that we don't have a Japanese market and a European market and a U.S. market. You talked about this liquidity, and I've been on this bandwagon for a long time. I honestly wish we had separate markets that weren't twined together, because as one goes, they all go. What do we got? The three musketeers, Japan, U.S., Europe. Like, if one goes,
yeah,
you know, and my evidence for that has been this, which is in the equity markets, they now trade indistinguishably from each other. So I'm going to show you, here's a 1-day. This is just today. These are 5-minute charts. If I stripped off, and I know I've said this many, many times, but if I stripped off the names, if I didn't tell you this was the Euro Stoxx 50 and this was the NASDAQ 100 and this is the Japanese Nikkei, which is closed at the moment, so this is just their futures trading, the Russell 2000, the Dow Jones, like small caps, major caps, technology, Germany, Europe, because Germany's down here, they all look exactly identical. So that tells me the plumbing is linked. There's no difference. Europe, tech, big tech, small tech, Japan, it's all one thing, which is fine until you get into some sort of an accident where you have a monetary or a fiscal accident. Oh no, Japan has a monetary accident. And you think, what does that have to do with us? It has everything to do with us, because we're all riding on the same sea of global liquidity right now. And I don't think they should have allowed that to happen regulatorily, but that's an editorial comment.
Well, and that just shows the correlation. So what diversification are you going to get from there? So correlation, just for the listeners out there, if you have a correlation of one, you have positive correlation, negative correlation. So just keep it simple. You got a correlation of one. So if it's correlated to the S&P and the S&P goes up 10%, this asset should go up 10%. If the S&P goes down 10%, it should go down 10%. That's positive correlation of one. That's essentially what you're seeing there. What you're supposed to get through diversification is ideally less correlation and some negative correlation. So if you had a negative correlation of 1 to the S&P and the S&P goes up 10, then that other asset should go down 10 and vice versa. But the more correlated markets become, the less diversification you have. Investors think it's great because their statements are going up, but they have no protection if they're passively allocated in this modern portfolio theory approach, just like 2022. In 2022, bond market was down 20%. And equities were down 20%. They had the same correlation that year, which was the worst year in 40 years. So what are investors going to do if they're looking over the past 30, 40 years and they project that into the future? Oh, that was once in a 40-year event. It won't happen again. My concern is we're seeing a dramatic change in the overall markets as we reach the end of this monetary and fiscal dominance, where we have a monetary accident, not, and you're going to have some traditional assets in your portfolio that Wall Street just does not recommend. You know, there are a few people coming out now because you're going to need that diversification to help, because they're all acting the same, and there's no diversification when they're all acting the same.
No, there isn't. This is kind of a new development. I mean, I'm old enough to remember that, you know, diversification meant, oh, stocks and bonds, but also international, emerging, all this stuff, right? But if they're all trading as a single hive mind Borg with a correlation of 1, right? And people say, oh, Chris, that was just today. That was a 5-minute chart. Here's the same charts looking at it on a weekly basis. See that little W right there? Again, you have to kind of squint to see any difference in behavior between any of these things, right? You know?
Mm-hmm.
They're all kind of behaving the same. So they're behaving the same on a weekly basis. And they're kind of behaving the same on a daily basis, tick for tick, right? So again, and this is just stocks, but this just tells me, Paul, that what we have is this creates a fairly stable system where volatility, the VIX, can stay low and compressed and everything's fine. You can have really tight spreads between junk bonds and AAA bonds, right? Which we do. Again, I don't know how that's happening, right? So everything's calm until it's not. And this creates a coiled spring that I think people just need to be aware of, but harkens back to, you know, how did Hemingway go broke? Slowly, then all at once, you know? So that's how I see these markets. They're going to behave slowly. They've been behaving slowly for 20 years now, but they could get coiled spring, just like we saw with gold and silver. That beach ball, when it slipped out of their grasp, it was fairly sudden.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I know a lot of people wishing that they'd taken action before the beach ball slipped, and they're like, oh, it's too late now, and they're feeling left out of the game, and I get that. But if this is true, what we're talking about, if Japan is about to have this moment, we're just getting started. We haven't seen anything yet. It's going to be wildly volatile.
I agree. And for those that think that it's too late because they didn't do anything, I don't think it's too late, but it's harder now. Okay, when you have this type of move that takes place in silver and gold, it is much harder in the short run because, look, we can have a 30 or 40% decline. You talked about that in the last two podcasts with what happened in Germany and German marks to gold. We can have those declines, and those are things that, at least with the information we have right now, not a recommendation, just educational purposes here, that one should consider if appropriate to allocate some capital. But there's no guarantee that we get those 30 to 40% declines. That's why it's harder here. Okay. It's just harder. So I've been excruciatingly patient and allocating for clients that don't have exposure, that are new, that have started working with us to get there. And everybody's antsy. I'm antsy. They're antsy because, look, we could just keep marching higher from here to $120 in silver. But again, being that it's harder here, you know, we're still moving, but you want to average in at this point to get to your exposure. There's just not going to be perfection here. And going back to what you were talking about, that interview that Luke Groman mentioned, you're going to have to sacrifice a little bit of your butterflies in the short term to pay attention to where we are in the long term. Because if Japan is blowing up, which it looks like it is, and the yen carry trade, and you've got, you know, China, India, the BRICS, that because of their lack of trust in the U.S., system in the dollar, where are they going to go? At least right now, there's very few places to go. And I'd rather own something that has a zero-tier asset, as you call it, like gold and silver, is my safety hedge. Now, should you go all in? That's speculating. There's a difference between investing and speculating. So it's just harder here. And I think you've got to be patient, and you have to keep some powder dry in case we do get those deflationary impulses as we're headed forward.
I will confess, every single time I've bought gold and silver, it's been hard. And I agree, today's harder, right? You know, particularly if you look at just the price levels. Now, I had a couple of important interviews this week talking with people like David Russell, the CEO of Goldcorp. And what he was noting from the international standpoint, first, big money is starting to move in, meaning they're getting these big orders, like piling in. Two, he said that it's an obvious shift in the conversations that they're having with these people, because he said it used to be kind of a trade or a trade-like or a trading sort of a thing, like, is now a good time to get in? Should I wait for a pullback? You know, I'll buy some now, but let's set a floor, a stop loss. Like, they were sort of just thinking about it as a trade. He said they're not having that conversation. Now they're having the conversation of, I need this many ounces, right? I'd like to have this many kilos or ounces, right? They have targets now that they're setting. And that's a big shift, because they're not thinking about it as this thing that's one of many things. I own some GM, I own some sovereign debt of Belgium, or whatever your stories are. And now they're thinking about it as the tier zero asset, which is like, I'd like some ounces, kilos.
Right.
You know?
Right. And I would say, you know, this is the thing that I've been telling clients for years, with the percentage that you have as your long-term hedge, you know, this is a part of the portfolio that we want to buy into the gold and silver assets, and we want to set it on the shelf for 10 years. And 10 years from now, we hope that it's the same price that it is today, right? But if we've had these events continue to unfold, it's going to be like fire insurance on your portfolio is what it is. So if you go back 10 years ago in 2016, what gold was $1,100 an ounce? You purchased that mentally. You set your mind so volatility or lack of movement didn't bother you. You wake up today and look at it, and you're, would you say, $4,800 an ounce it is today, somewhere around there. And, you know, what has that done? That's helped protect your purchasing power. Is all it's done, and it's helped protect the wealth, your savings that you have had there. So, you know, I still think it's an important part of the portfolio as we go through this fourth turning and everything starts to unravel around the globe. And it's not going to be easy, but for those that are courageous and decide to take the path less traveled, it's going to be rewarding, but it's not going to be an easy path.
Yeah, and there's some things I really think people should consider at this point in time, because it relates to this idea of the system. Now, this is hard for me to convey, Paul, because I've been actively watching these markets for 30 years, and you know how I watch things. I watch them very carefully. I study them. I try and figure out everything I can. And even with all of that, I don't know what's going on, you know, because I can't find anybody else who can really explain the whole thing. Hypothesis, I don't think anybody knows how they work anymore. Because I can find people who can tell me about this piece of the plumbing, right? Oh, here's how they handle OTC margin requirements for this subclass of derivatives. Like, oh, okay, you know. But I don't understand, you know, I can't find anybody who can give me the whole thing, you know. And that's what 2008-09 almost was it almost froze the plumbing of the system completely, and that scared them. So they did some things. They passed some laws, and I think everybody needs to know about what those laws are. And Paul, we're going to discuss that just as soon as we come back. Hey folks, Chris Martinson here. Look, we've all been there, watching our hard-earned dollars get chewed up by this endless inflation machine, while the folks in Washington and the big banks continue to play games with our money like it's Monopoly cash or something. It's not right. I know it, and you know it. The trust in the system? It's eroding faster than a sandcastle at high tide, especially with all the geopolitical storms brewing. Now, I've been saying it for years. You've got to protect yourself, your family, from all this nonsense. That's why I personally turn to gold and silver, the real deal, physical stuff that you can hold in your hands under your control, not some digital promise that could vanish overnight. Everyone should own some. It's just common sense in times like these. But here's the thing. When I need it stored securely, away from prying eyes, I use Goldcorp. They're the ones I trust. They ship it right to your door, really quick if you want to hold it in your hands, but also if you prefer, they can stash it in top-tier vaults in places like Switzerland or Singapore or right here in the United States. Your call, your metal. And for you, my friends who follow Peak Prosperity, they'll hook you up with the first 6 months of storage absolutely free. That's how much they value real people like us. Buying and selling? Hey, it's as easy as trading stocks, but way better. Because with Goldcore, you're the sole owner. Fully allocated, fully segregated, in your name only. No sharing with strangers, no funny business, no security entitlement nonsense. Need cash fast? Sell in seconds at market price? Want it in your hands? Hey, one click and it's shipped. They've got everything from coins and bars to allowing for self-directed IRAs, all locked down and secure. It's simple, it's safe, and straightforward. Take charge of your future, folks. Don't wait for the system to fail you any further. Head over to peak.fan/goldcore. That's peak.fan/goldcore right now and claim that free storage. You won't regret it. I sure don't. Welcome back, everybody. And we were just discussing this idea of the response of the keepers of the system here in the U.S., but also Europe, if the system ever froze again, because it was almost this, they saw this light at the end of the tunnel in 2009, and it was an oncoming freight train, and they got very scared. And when they get scared, what do? Well, they change the rules, right? That's just what they are. So they started writing these laws in, which became collectively known as what David Webb called the Great Taking, right? And the Great Taking is just a set of gobbledygook legal language, but basically says that in a real pinch, they're just going to come in and seize assets from the system to recapitalize it so that it can get unfrozen. And I understand why they might think that's super important. But the problem is that a lot of people, Paul, don't know that what they consider to be their assets. Hey, this is my portfolio. Hey, I paid after-tax money and took risks and accumulated these assets inside the financial system. I know because here they are in my brokerage statement. They're mine. They don't know that, depending on circumstances and conditions, they're not theirs. And so you've done more than anybody else I've known to help people do the best they possibly can to take things out of the jaws of the lion and put them over here outside the cage, maybe somewhere a little bit safer. Just maybe we should talk about that real quick, because I think people need to consider this.
Yes, absolutely. And I'll tell you one thing that blew my mind yesterday afternoon. I was listening to an interview with Mike Green, and I wish I could give it credit because it's on my phone and I don't even know who was interviewing him. It was just Mike Green, so I wanted to listen to it. And he was talking about the fact that Vanguard had this major announcement of a 30% cut in some of their fees from 0.3 to 0.2. And he put a zinger out that I've not had a chance to go back and verify yet, but it's Mike Green, so he knows what he's talking about, but I still like to go verify. He said that, you know, it sounded like a big deal and it's good marketing on their part. But the reality is the largest amount of their revenue comes from securities lending. And right. So if the largest part of their revenue comes from securities lending, I've got to get in and dig into that a little bit because, you know, if you're in a top one account, they're not supposed to be lending. So maybe it has to do with some other structure that they have set up. So, you know, to kind of help, you know, for listeners out there, one of the things that you can do to protect yourself.
Explain that real quick, the type one, type two, real quick.
That's where I was going.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
So type one and type two. So there are two basic structures in brokerage accounts. Okay, whether it's a non-retirement account or retirement accounts are a little bit harder, but you can have type one versus type two. So a type two account is typically where you can lend against your securities. So if you want to borrow on margin, like when I was with corporate, and I've talked to a couple of my friends at corporate, like one of the incentives that the corporations give their advisors for trips, bonuses, things of that nature, is to convince investors to loan against their securities. So let's say you've got stock X and you've accumulated a huge amount of money in there and you want to go buy a piece of real estate, you can put that in a type two account, and that type two account allows you to borrow against it. Okay. Now, if it's in that type two account and you're not borrowing against it because your broker has suggested that you do that, then that allows the broker dealer under the law to go out and lend those securities out to short sellers, to other people. So that's where you get into the great taking collateral risk. Now, on the other side, you have your type one accounts. Now, your type one accounts do not have marginability, and under the law, the broker dealers are not allowed to go out and lend upon those securities. So the first thing that you want to do to protect yourself against the great taking, as much as you can, make sure you're in a type one account. I mean, that's simple, because under the law, the broker dealers are not allowed to use your securities to lend out. If you're in a type two account, margin versus non-margin. So a lot of times it's a non-margin account is type one, type two is a margin account. If you're in a margin account, then they can lend your securities out and make money that they don't have to share with you if you're not utilizing that. So that's one basic thing that everybody should do.
So let's say you have a type two account, Paul, and you've got 1,000 shares of company X, and I've decided I want to short company X, and I just happen to go to your particular broker dealer structure, and I say, I'd like 500 shares of X to short. And they say, sure, no problem. They might be lending me your shares.
Right. Correct.
Without your knowledge.
That's,
and they're
going to
charge me for that, by the way. It's, you know, there's going to be fees associated with that. So they're incentivized to do that, right? They make money. And you wake up one day and you're like, no, I got 1,000 shares right here. But you don't really. You have 500 and 500 with an asterisk on them because I took them.
Right.
And then I might have sold those short into the market.
Right.
And let's say you're a different guy and you bought those 500 shares and you put them in your margin account. Well, now they get to lend out half of those, right? And so if they ever had to ring the bell and we said, oh, settle this all up, it might be that those 500 shares you gave me have been sold multiple times, right?
Yes.
That's the so-called rehypothecation, right? So it's like it's been sold and resold, and nobody really knows. And it's all good as long as the music's playing. But if the music stops and we have to find a chair, that's where things get a little hinky. Is how I understand it.
And all you need is one counterparty to fail, and it ripples through the entire system because of the leverage upon leverage and the rehypothecation upon rehypothecation. So that's why it's ridiculously important to have your accounts in a top one account. And the second thing is, look, I know option strategies are sexy. You can do covered calls. You can do puts. You can do all of these things. They're more tax efficient. They're great. But what has Wall Street done? Okay, they have fully convinced all of the retail investors out there, as well as professional investors, to use options. Well, we had seriously considered back in 2013-14, because they are sexy. Look, I get it, and I know they're great strategies as long as things are going well, but I didn't feel comfortable with it. And, you know, I mean, I had some really good strategies that we put together, but I'd go to sleep, and I'd say my prayers at night, I'd wake up 3 o'clock in the morning. Normally, I would pray, settle my mind down, but that just never left my mind. So I'm like, okay, Lord, what is it? What's the deal with this? Okay, and you can make fun of me all you want, because we're 12 years later, right? 10, 12 years later, and we haven't had a major blow up, but there's something important about this. So as I was kind of seeking wisdom, is should we be implementing these for clients under risk management, clients in retirement? I see Warren Buffett come out. He talks about the reason why they don't use options or derivatives in a major scale is because he calls them weapons of mass financial destruction. Okay, so think about that. Warren Buffett calls them weapons of mass financial destruction. So we decided to walk away from it at that point. And I wondered whether we had regretted that over time. But as you're in your business and your strategies, you work with clients, that becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. Then we get this information about the great taking. And then I realized why in hindsight, it looks like that was a blessing that was answered through that prayer. Because if that great taking does occur, and look, the infrastructure is there and the leverage and the rehypothecation and Buffett warning people. He understands the internal workings of the market better than any of us do, probably because of his position over his life of watching that come up. He calls them weapons of mass financial destruction. Take heed of that warning. I mean, please do. Because if you're running option strategies all the time, typically you have to be in a type two account. And my other argument is, how great does an option of put on the market work? So let's say you stay fully invested, but you cover your entire position of your portfolio with a put. Market goes down 60 or 70%. Well, That's great as long as you don't have any counterparties fail. That's great as long as the great taking doesn't occur. But what happens if that option doesn't pay because the great taking occurs and these counterparties fail? Well, now you're down 50, 60, 70% in your portfolio, and that option didn't do any good. So that's one of the reasons why I tell clients right now where we are with the information we have as a fiduciary, I'm not using puts on the portfolio. That doesn't mean that I may use them in the future. You're better off to sell, place those funds. Yes, there's issues with treasuries from a long-term standpoint, but the safest asset you can, because we have the knowledge of the potential for the great taking now, and that would be absolutely devastating to the portfolios of individuals if that was to, you know, if you're relying on options to protect you on the other side.
Yeah, it's well said. And there are a lot of other, I know, things you walk clients through in terms of how accounts are structured and all this and that. Listen, no guarantees in life, but at a minimum, I think people should be aware of it and look at how they can protect themselves within the system itself. Listen, they may change the rules again. I don't actually know. But given how the rules are understood at this point in time, I think it's really important. And, you know, it was probably almost 2 years ago now when I did that great taking series and really dove into it. And you know what surprised me was I'd activated various people, some of them fairly high net worth, and they went straight to like the Fidelity legal department, you know, and said, is this true? And the Fidelity legal department was like, no, absolutely not. And then I would send them an email and say, ask him this question. And over time, I found I was educating the legal departments of brokerage houses about what the law said. Like, it's just law. I'm not making anything up. I'm not interpreting anything crazy. I'm like, there's uniform commercial code at the state level. There's title law. Typically, you know, the titles 12 and 11, right? Bankruptcy and banking. And I was just like, here's the law. Like, give them the language. What does this say? And it was amazing. They didn't know about it. So no, if people go to their big institutional brokers and say, what about this thing I heard about? And they say, oh, that's nothing. I would invite you to ask more probing questions. Because they might not know.
Absolutely. And they don't want to talk about it, quite frankly, because they don't know what to do about it. And, you know, I remember what I think from discovery, Chris, it was 9 months to the webinar. Am I correct on that? Because mm-hmm. I've been telling everybody it was like 3.5 years of college in 9 months while working full time.
Yep.
Like, I mean, the amount of study that you did, that we did on our side trying to figure it out. So, you know, that, and compartmentalizing, you can maximize security investor protection coverage. Okay. Maximize FDIC coverage. Don't be complacent out there if you're in CDs and get over your $250,000 limit. Now, is there any guarantee that FDIC is going to stand or SIPC is going to stand, Security Investor Protection Corporation? Now, let me explain a big difference. FDIC is a guaranteed return of your asset if that bank fails, okay, up to $250,000. And there's nuances to that. SIPC, Security Investor Protection Corporation, does not protect you from a foolish investment. So if you go out and buy stock XYZ and it goes bankrupt, Security Investor Protection does not cover you. What Security Investor Protection does, SIPC, is if your broker-dealer rehypothecates your assets and they were to fail, you're covered up to $500,000. Okay, now, you can structure through multiple broker-dealers in different types of accounts. So if you have $2 million in an IRA, then you've only got $500,000. You can do different types of retirement accounts and maximize that SIPC and then use multiple broker dealers. So like in our case, Fidelity's our preferred. We use Charles Schwab as our second. If you've got a joint account, you know, $1.5 million in assets. Now there's estate planning issues, so it has to be personalized. On that $1.5 million joint account, you got $500,000 of SIPC. Well, if everything goes to zero and you get $500,000, you're still better off than what you would be. But all you have to do is take that joint account, then take one of the joint and open an individual TOD to the other spouse and another individual TOD. And now you can go to $1.5 million of SIPC. So there are simple things that you can do. Yeah, you're going to have more statements. You're going to have, you know, more accounts associated with that. Maybe two broker dealers that you're having to deal with. But it doesn't cost you anything if you're with the right broker dealer. You know, some broker dealers charge per account, but there are little things like that that you can do to be as prudent as possible. So that's what we do, Chris, in going through that. You know, the Bible tells us twice in Proverbs, the prudent foresee danger and hide themselves while the simple pass on and are judged for it. So if you're aware of the great taking, you have some wisdom and you have a choice. Am I going to be simple and complacent, or am I going to be prudent? And I encourage you, where we are at this point in the cycle, look, if the price-earnings ratio on the S&P was 10, be as complacent as you want to be. But we're at the most expensive valuations in history, the most leverage that we've ever seen, debt accumulated across the board. What happened to the Great Depression? That debt collapsed upon itself, and we had deflation. So we're at a point in time where you need to be prudent and foresee that danger. We can foresee the risk of the great taking. Will it happen? We don't know, but it's certainly there. So don't be complacent. Be prudent, and that's what we're doing for clients and everybody that we're working with.
And I have that's a great explanation. I have one. So I continue to study this, and there's an update I would be providing that I've learned since, and it's about that SIPC protection. There's two ways that you can lose. So let's say you're with big brokerage house A, and they accidentally, go belly up because they mismanaged risk. They had a lot of shares out on loan. They forgot to collect the right amount of margin. There's an accident, and it turns out their capital that they have on their balance sheet is insufficient to cover that loss. So they go into receivership. Okay, SIPC covers you in that receivership moment. If you're in a type 2 account and your shares were caught up in all that and they got lost, baby, they're gone. They are gone. But if you're in a type 1 account, what SIPC does is they say, so dust settles. They open up the books of this failed brokerage, and they were supposed to have 1 million shares of company Y for everybody. Well, they only have 800,000 because they lost 200,000. The 800,000 that are remaining get divvied amongst the type 1 accounts that said they had those. If there's any left over, they use those to satisfy this side. So it means that actually it's 500,000 of losses. So type 1 accounts may experience much, much lower losses because their shares weren't actually caught up in all that kerfluffle over there, right? We're not supposed to be. The part I'm less clear on, and I haven't got a good answer to, because there's this little thing in there that says, unless due to fraud, if brokerage A is fraudulent and knowingly defrauds you by saying they're not going to touch your type 1 shares, but use them anyway, it's a little less clear about how all that sorts itself out. All I could determine from that was it's probably safest to use really well-known, very big, entities rather than smaller ones. But that's as close as I could get. I don't like this. Paul, I hate it that it's this complicated. I hate it. It shouldn't be this hard. If I own it, I should own it. That should be that.
It should be.
I don't need 400 pages of legal language to tell me under which conditions I might or might not own some or all or part or none. Ugh. Anyway.
What's the classic banker scheme throughout history? You know, even when people would deposit their gold at the local banks and then they would, you know, lend it out more than the gold that they had, and then it would inevitably collapse on itself. Mm-hmm. But this is just human nature cycles that we go through. Now, I do want to say, look, I have an association with Fidelity. I'm not employed by Fidelity because as an RIA, we're independent. But I've got to give them kudos because they demonstrated for my attorney that they do not rehypothecate type 1 accounts. And one of my favorite email exchanges was when I gave you kind of, you know, was sharing with you the results, and you're like, what about to the sixth decimal? And I was like, okay. So I sent it back to my attorney, and he started laughing. He's like, seriously? And I said, hey, he's got a point. And they answered that for us. So what was great about Fidelity and makes me a lot more confident with them than some of the other broker dealers that we were associated with, not only did they engage in the conversation, they answered our questions. Mm-hmm. And they demonstrated it to the attorneys, demonstrated it back and forth, where some of the other broker dealers, they wouldn't even engage in conversation. It doesn't mean that they're doing anything wrong, but I don't have that clarity, right, that lets me have the nice warm and fuzzies. So with the ones that wouldn't demonstrate for us, I don't want to keep anything more than what SIPC coverage will cover in that standpoint to get some extra protection, because we just don't know what that risk is. Whereas we can quantify it a little bit better with the broker dealer like Fidelity that said, hey, you know, we don't think this is going to happen, but at least we'll entertain and explain why, you know, that we are following the law on the type one accounts.
Well, kudos to Fidelity and kudos to you for even taking it up. I talked with a number of other financial professionals who just wouldn't touch it. They just couldn't engage in the conversation, either because they didn't know what to do about it or felt like it would create some career risk within their structured organization if they even brought it up. I don't know what the story was, but I found that like saying, hey, Fidelity engaged, these other people didn't. I'm going to go with the people who engaged with this, because that's the only way to go through life at this point, right? You have to engage with these things, whether you like them or not. You got to understand them.
Well, I'll tell you my initial reaction when I read it. So I think I probably got the book from one of our clients, one of my clients. I think it was a Friday. So I read it Friday afternoon. I can't remember right before I went to bed. Now, I read it and I was like, oh, I don't even know what to think about this. And I read it again on Saturday. I'm like, I got to call Chris. And I was like, no. I'm going to wait till, you know, Sunday afternoon or Monday, and I'm going to call you. And then you called and you're like, man, I just read this thing about the great taking. I was kind of in shock. Like, can this really happen?
Yep.
And absolutely it can. I mean, that was... You know, that was the interesting thing, is trying to prove it wrong, and you couldn't prove it wrong. I mean, matter of fact, the more I tried to prove it wrong, and especially with the information you laid out, and for those listeners that are out there, the work in the webinar that you did, that Chris did on the great taking, is still relevant today, and it still has strategies in there that you can implement to protect yourself. So that work is not outdated at this point at all in any way.
Thanks. Everybody should be aware of that. And, if we could switch gears now for the time we have remaining, I want to talk about, because, you know, you and I have been on about a number of things of late. One of them is this bubble, potentially, AI bubble, right? And we noted some very weird things, like there was this 1 point whatever trillion of CapEx that even OpenAI was sort of signed up for, and there was no revenue model that was going to justify that. But everybody's like, oh, it doesn't, revenues will come later. We've got to build it now. So it's Field of Dreams. We build it and they will come. It never quite penciled out. I think, Paul, that we see that writing is clearly on the wall now. George Noble here writing, and he's a fund manager. And he said, OpenAI is falling apart in real time. I've watched companies implode for decades. This one has all the warning signs. OpenAI declared code red in December. Sam Altman sent an internal memo telling employees to drop everything because Google's Gemini 3 is eating their lunch. Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff publicly ditched ChatGPT for Gemini after using it for 2 hours. ChatGPT traffic fell in November. Remember, this was supposed to just go exponential forever. Second month-over-month decline of 2025. Meanwhile, Gemini jumped to 650 million monthly active users. The company that was supposed to build AGI can't keep its chatbot competitive. But the real story is the money, as it always is. OpenAI lost $12 billion in a single quarter, according to Microsoft's own fiscal disclosures. Deutsche Bank estimates $143 billion in cumulative negative cash flow, not a good phrase, before the company turns profitable. And that might be infinity if this continues. Their analysts put it bluntly, no startup in history has operated with losses on anything approaching this scale. We knew this was going to happen, right? Obviously, any new technology, winners and losers, sometimes the first horse out of the gate looks like the leader, but later turns out, you know, to be the Betamax of the war, and it doesn't quite pencil out. Lots of warning signs coming out about this now, and not least of which is the data centers. They can't even build them because they don't have the power for them.
No.
And
what good does it do to build an asset that you're going to have to replace in 3 years as far as all those semiconductors if you can't power it for 2 to 3 or 4 years? You're just wasting money.
Yeah.
You know, what's fascinating is I had not seen that data. But I watched the top seven, you know, the largest cap stocks, just to pay attention for a sign of potential topping of the market, because they're 38 to 42% of the S&P 500, depending. But I have noticed a huge divergence between Google. So Google's been breaking out to new highs while Microsoft's been basing and starting to break down. So I've been watching this over the past several months, really over the past week. We've started to see some breakdowns in Microsoft and breakouts in Google. That makes sense right there. Those investors that know are starting to shift because it's two completely different charts based on both of those companies.
Yeah. And just to be clear, Microsoft put a big, big bet on OpenAI, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that could be, but it's a real horse race out there, and there are so many different models out there right now, and each of them kind of does some things. I don't have my arms around it at all, but I'm looking at all of them now with new eyes because they've changed so rapidly over the past few months, and of course we've got China's competition around all of that, and so still I think it's fair to say. Trillions have sort of been dedicated into the market caps of these companies and into the dream under the idea that we had clear line of sight into where this was going to go. And now there's some wrinkles in the story, and this is all that bubbles actually need. Despite that, well, we've talked about, you and I, this crack up boom. Tracy Schuchart, Chi-Girl on Twitter, pointing out January inflows into equity-focused ETFs are running at 5 times the average for the month, with funds attracting a record $400 billion over the past 3 months, a sign of just how aggressive risk appetite has become. That's astonishing. $400
it's
billion.
Absolutely, absolutely astonishing.
That's the crack up boom. Just FOMO. You got to get in, Paul. You got to get it while you can. This is only going up. Can't lose. I mean, this is like that. This is astonishing behavior, particularly if you're at the tail end of a particular story.
Well, and notice, look, see that first surge that occurred between 20 to 22?
Mm-hmm.
And what happened just in time for the market to have a pretty nasty correction in 22. And quite frankly, I think this bull market would have been over if the AI euphoria had not have come back. So now we've got this major influx, but the equity markets haven't moved in response to all of that money that's been coming in. So
yeah.
It hasn't impacted it, you know, to the point that you would expect it to. So, but that tells me that investors have become convinced that these markets are bulletproof because they're basing themselves off of hindsight bias. But at the same time, you know, that's U.S. equity ETF flows across the board. I mean, if you go back and take a look at performance year to date, let me get down here and see if I can find that. You know, gold, commodities and emerging markets have substantially outperformed U.S. equities. So that's a little counterintuitive there, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I think I have one more possible explanation for this, which is, yeah, I can explain it here. So there's competing ideas. There's a crack up boom. So that's at the end of all this flood of money. M2's growing like crazy. Central banks are printing. Governments are deficit spending. And you get that burst at the end, and that's normal for a bubble. But we've heard this term, the debasement trade. And so, you know, people say, oh, well, Chris, you know, the dollar's at 99. It hasn't really fallen yet. And I'm like, no. That's because you're comparing it to other currencies. And that's like saying 5 skydivers jumped out of a plane and the dollar's falling a little less slowly than the other 4. You know, but when you look at the dollar or the yen or the real or whatever you want against gold, you say they're all falling, right? So The debasement trade, so in Japan, bonds are tanking. The yen is weak. What do you do? Well, you jump into the stock market. So this is the Nikkei, right? And you can see it here clearly on this 45-degree Markopoulos ramp here, which is normally a sign of, you know, fraud in the market. But that's a pretty nice 45-degree angle going from 35,000 to 52,000 over, well, this is 2025 March, April, May, right in here, right? From that April low, look at that. Wow. 30,000 it almost tagged, 52,000. Why is that? Like, why would somebody who doesn't want Japanese sovereign debt, doesn't want the Japanese sovereign currency, why would they want Japanese companies? And the answer is, is that if you're trapped in that system and you have to spend your yen on something, you might as well buy companies because you no longer trust the sovereign side of the story. So you're trusting the private side of the story. And that's a different flavor from the debasement trade, which makes it sort of sound like we're just fighting inflation. It's worse than that. It means somebody's worried about sovereign risk because Sony, if they're priced in yen, can still make lots of yen even if the yen is collapsing or the government bonds are in default in some structural way. That's what I think is happening here.
I'm curious about one thing, though, because the Japanese market, you know, peaked in 89 and didn't see that level. I think it was for 35 years. Mm-hmm. I wonder what the price-to-earnings ratio is on the Nikkei. And
that I don't know.
I asked Grok right now. It's still doing some research just out of curiosity. If it was less valued, you know, than what the U.S. equity markets are.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, if you're going to have your assets invested somewhere, I don't know that that's as simple for a U.S. investor because we've been the only game in town for a while. But if I had to choose one asset, the only thing I had to choose was equities, and we're in the midst of that debasement trade and that's taking place, then you're better off to own equities and the ability to have increased earning and power through that inflation than you are to own 20 or 30 year treasuries. I'm a little suspect that we're at that state part of the stage. I'm still thinking we're at this investor euphoria and that we're going to get some pullback before we get that ultimate crack up boom and the collapse of the currencies that nobody wants to own. With that being said, I want to share one thing because I do think this is interesting. Just year-to-date action. In the first 10 days of the year tend to be very important from a historical standpoint. If you go back and look at the majors, this is starting January 1st, I think. The orange is OUNZ to represent gold. That's the VanEck 100% gold-backed ETF. It's up 11.8 so far year-to-date. The beige is emerging markets, EEM. That's up 6% year-to-date. You've got GNX, which is the Goldman Commodity Index, which is up 4.8 as of today. EFA is up 2.1. Well, you take the NASDAQ is down 0.72 for the year, even with the most recent rally, and the SPX is down 0.32, and then the green is the AGG. So in spite of all of that money flowing into U.S. equity ETFs, oof, what's outperforming?
Wow, right.
So my question is if we're actually in that debasement trade, I don't think the S&P 500 is the one that you absolutely need to own because that's not what we're seeing in the price action right now in spite of all that money flow. Now, look, this is a short-term window, guys. This is 30 days. But, you know, you get these hints of where you need to be, and our strategy is continuing to see increased an increase in evidence that ex-U.S. is going to be better in the days and years ahead if we get into that debasement trade than what the S&P may be good, right? But if the S&P goes up 10 in a debasement trade, but other assets go up 40, 50, or 60, then you're protecting your assets, your purchasing power better. And the only way you can do that is adaptive strategies that can guide you in that manner. But I do think that that is important, especially taking into consideration the sheer amount of money that's been thrown into U.S. equity ETFs based on what you shared just then.
That's just in the ETFs. Where did $400 billion go? That should have, like, really spiked some prices. How do you spend $400 billion and not, like, move prices?
Right.
There's a leak in the boat.
There's a leak in the boat. I was going to say it's basic supply and demand.
Yep.
So, you know, that means some assets, whatever those assets are selling into that liquidity, and it looks like they're moving into the other assets. You know, that was my point in looking at that. You've got all supply and demand drives price, right? So if you have more demand than you have supply, which is what we're seeing in gold and silver right now, those prices are going up. You had a massive amount of demand come into U.S. equities, but it's underperforming all those other assets year to date. I think that's a very important signal, at least in the short run, that's probably going to continue to be confirmed as we go forward over this year.
Mm-hmm. Where has that money been going? Where has it been going? It's a mystery, Paul. I don't know.
Oh, that reminds me, one other asset that I wanted to show here, okay? And I think this matters too. So Kobayashi letter comes out and points this through Azure Capital, but they go through and say, India is stockpiling silver. India's silver imports spiked to a record $5.9 billion over the last 4 months. That marks a 400% increase since Q4 24. It's now 64% above the 2022 peak. By comparison, imports averaged $1.5 billion a year from 2013 to 2019. India is one of the world's largest silver consumers, with demand driven by jewelry fabrication, physical silver, rising industrial use in electronics and solar energy. Meanwhile, India's Nifty 50 Metal Index, which tracks major metal and mining companies, is having its best start to the year since 2018. As a result, the Nifty 50 Metal Index to Nifty 50 ratio is up to the highest level in 11 years, as metals significantly outperform the broader market. India's silver rush is accelerating. So look at this. You know, if we look at, we see what's happening in the silver price. What we're looking at silver is that's record high in demand from Indian silver imports. And what are we seeing? Massive records in silver right now. So that tells me supply and demand's making a major impact on silver coming out of India right now, where that major flow of money coming into U.S. equities has kind of been blah at this point.
Which means, again, there's a hole in the boat. So somebody's buying, somebody's selling, and therefore the price doesn't move.
Yes. And if I go back and look at the S&P, I mean, we've pretty much just been in the same range for the past 3 or 4 months. So that's just another mile marker as an investor that tells us we need to be paying attention, we need to be prepared to walk the path less traveled, and we need to be prepared to be adaptive to protect ourselves if we are at the end game here. And I believe, I don't know where we are in the journey, but the mile markers that keep saying we're closer and closer and closer for those that aren't adaptive and don't have a strategy to help them dance through the streets of Rome while it's burning to the ground, they're going to be in trouble. That was pretty dark. Sorry for you guys out there. But I mean, but I can't stress enough just how serious this is. I mean, it is serious. And just when investors are fully convinced that their investment can't go wrong, and that can happen even in gold and silver, just when they're fully convinced that their thesis cannot be wrong is typically when it is wrong, because that's when it's easy to buy. The best investments are the ones that make you nervous to purchase them, quite frankly.
So this is fascinating. So you encouraged me to just jump over, take a quick peek at the 1 year performance of the S&P 500, and this is how it's presented on finviz.com, one of my favorite ways to sort of peek at these things. And I've got a few hidden down here. So just if you're wondering, consumer stuff, Walmart up 28%, but this is over the year. Speaking to what you said before, if I can get this to not freak out of me, Google's up 65% over the last year. NVIDIA, I'm surprised. I thought it would have been up more than that over the past year. So it's kind of stalled a bit. Wow. Micron up 266%. Clear big winner there. But if the tech boom is over, we're going to see more of these things start to fade a little bit. Interestingly, when you see this in the software side of things, Paul, look at this.
Mm-hmm.
Now Adobe... Yeah. CRM, I mean, unbelievable. These are some pretty big numbers. The reason for this, I've heard, is that it turns out people are going to be able to write their own software for free really soon, and some people already are using, in particular, Cloud and Claude. So people are writing their own bespoke software all on their own. So it turns out we might not need one of the big victims in the AI thing. Maybe enterprise software. And based on my experience with Microsoft this past week, personal, not a recommendation for or against, but it turns out, Paul, when your computer crashes, for some reason Microsoft has not yet figured out how to actively save all your documents that were in flight. Even if you set, please save this every 1 minute for me, can't do it. But when it comes to spying on you and downloading all your information, it does that flawlessly. So
that it does.
So good riddance, you know, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and we learned a long, long time ago. I guess it's been 12 years when Windows 7 was no longer allowed to be used, one of the things that I have to run into is you have to be updated on all the security for protection of client assets. Mm-hmm. We back up every computer in the office every single night. And that's been a lifesaver time and time again. When something inevitably goes wrong, you might lose a half a day's worth of work, okay? But you're not losing 2 or 3 weeks worth of work. It's just amazing how much less efficient the software is now compared to what it was 10 or 15 years from now. And I will be thrilled if people can build their own software programs, because, you know, everybody's given this cookie cutter. I mean, that's going to be something that's going to be really good for innovation across the board. If that fact becoming a reality for individuals.
Yeah.
And businesses.
But isn't it also kind of amazing here that Amazon, supposed to be one of the big cloud services, just up 0.78% over the past year. This is the 1 year performance we're looking at. Microsoft barely hanging on to a gain here. Palantir way up, obviously. Apple 6.87% for the year. Not super exciting.
That's a massive loss of momentum.
It is.
That's a massive loss of momentum, quite frankly.
And what if we did the 1 month performance? Ooh, ouch. You can see where we are for the past month. And I think you already mentioned this. There's a big gap between this performance and this performance over here, between Microsoft and Google currently.
Down 9 versus 7.
Yeah.
That's what, a 16% spread between the two?
Yep.
That's relatively significant.
And interestingly, oil has not really begun moving yet, but look who is for the month.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Exxon up 14% and 0.5% for the month. I think we're getting our clues here, Paul. I feel like we're getting into that commodity cycle. I think it's starting.
That's one of the things I love about watching positions across all the markets and just different sectors, you know, just looking at it from the view from 30,000 feet. And, you know, and that pops up on my radar, and I'm, you know, I'll usually watch it when I see a divergence for a week or two before I start really digging in to try to figure out why. So I'm not even to the why point yet. I've just been looking at this big, but you give me one mile marker, one bit of evidence that tells us what's taking place between those two stocks and Google and Microsoft. And look, the big money, that's why I like following supply and demand and following the money around. The big money is not going to tell you what they're going to do before they do it, because there's such a big behemoth of money coming through. They're going to impact that price. So they're patient. They move 12 and 24 and 36 months ahead. And when they start moving fast, that's when you start to see these slowly and then all at once declines. And that divergence between Microsoft and Google, I think, is very important. The divergence we're seeing between the commodity complexes and the emerging markets and some of those others. I mean, the valuations are just so attractive compared to U.S. markets. Just math alone tells you that you should be making that move. But when big money's moving, is about the time that the returns look the best in hindsight. It's talked about the most on CNBC. It's the easiest for investors to buy, because most investors just want to buy what makes them feel comfortable, because everybody that they, you know, talk to is doing it, and the TV tells them that it's a good thing, because they're not actually doing the research themselves. And that's the reason I tell people when I run it, you know, when I'm, you know, they'll come in from time to time. Well, hey, I've been trading and doing great on my own for the past 6 or 7 years. Okay, good. We'll find out how good you are if you can survive a full market cycle. Because I've seen time and time again people that have this false confidence that they really are gifted in an area, when the reality is a bull market just made it easy for them, and they get wiped out by the time the bear inevitably comes. That's those cycles that we go through. And what's so frustrating from my standpoint about the government just continuing to riddle us with debt to try to kick this can down the road a little bit longer and a little bit longer is it's just continuing to fuel risk-taking and speculation with investors who really think they're investing, but they're speculating because they just don't understand the history of the markets and the full cycles. And just because they've been postponed for a while doesn't mean that they're not going to come roaring back with a vengeance. You can postpone the consequences of reality for a while, but you can't well, I butchered that, Chris, but you can't postpone the inevitable result. Guys, I'm sorry. I had a great line of thought going there. I thought until I said the quote. So you can
That's the Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand, she said,
he's going to come home.
You can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality.
There you go.
There it is.
I've had somebody tell me the other day I need to line quotes on the wall. I'm like, why do I need to know that? I just need to remember the quote. Chris knows exactly who it was.
Well, speaking of which, you know, in that thread, this idea that, you know, the government's already deficit spent $602 billion in the first 3 months of the fiscal year, and now Trump is throwing around as an opening bid, hey, how does $700 or $800 billion, I forget what the number is now, I think it'll be 800 when all is said and done, because he's offering 100,000 to each of the people who live in Greenland. But anyway, he's just like, where's that $800 billion going to come from? And what if Europe says, oh, okay, we'll sell it, but it's $1 trillion, right? Whatever. That's just going to get tacked right up like that. Where's that going to come from? We don't have that lying around. We're just going to have to, that's, I don't see anything but more printing, more printing, more printing. And I don't think I'm alone, Paul, and this is what we've been talking about. So while I've got all this up, it's just a lot of fun. This is just the one-month performance here across the futures sectors, right? So gold's up 10% on the month. Silver's up 38% on the month. Copper, palladium, platinum, 22% on the month. The month. You see crude oil beginning to move a little bit. Natural gas has just taken off like a scalded ape because of this big storm coming. So that's very volatile up and down. But S&P, as you mentioned, kind of flat.
Mm-hmm.
Whoops. NASDAQ down just a little bit. Japanese yen, of course, weakening here. So you look at this and it kind of looks like commodities are starting to shine here on a one-month basis, right? If we went back further, it would probably be a lot less clear three-month performance.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, 3 months, only 0.35%. Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
That's that stalling. That's that basing that I've been paying very close attention to with the S&P and the NASDAQ.
Hmm.
And look at the Russell 2000. The Russell 2000, that's where they say we've got market broadening. But a lot of the Russell 2000 has been overlooked for quite some time, so the valuations are so much more attractive than just the general S&P and the NASDAQ.
Yeah. But look at that, Bitcoin down 22% on a three-month basis. Whole story there that's brewing, I'm convinced. Big secular shift at this point in time. Is it the debasement trade? Is it just commodities time to shine? Did we get a little ahead of our skis with the AI story and got a little bubbly around all that? Has the market not fully digested the fact that the U.S. government is going to deficit spend like crazy, which I always knew, but I think it takes the market a little longer to catch up, right?
Yeah.
Of course they were. What else were they going to do? Particularly under a Trump presidency. Dude.
But the one thing that I'll say again, for the investors that are prepared, that have the courage to embrace the truth and follow the truth wherever it will take them, will come through this much better than the average person will. And, you know, look, sometimes it's not about building massive amounts of wealth. It's protecting what you have accumulated and making sure that your assets can generate the income that you need as long as the Lord gives you life. And I believe the evidence tells us more and more. Of course, I believe in an adaptive risk managed strategy, because that's helped us help clients to navigate the 2008 decline, all the things that we've been through, to shift into commodities, to allocate to gold in 2016. And not every investment turns out perfect. There's a lot that, you know, in hindsight, you're like, well, that didn't work out great, but you cut your losses quickly. You don't, you know, you got to set your pride on the table. You got to open your mind. You have to be adaptive and follow and have the courage to follow the truth wherever it will take you. And unlike Wall Street, that wants to tell you don't own this asset or don't own that asset, and they belittle these assets, you just have to look at the investments that are out there. They're all tools, right? And there's some tools that you may not use, but 5 years out of 30. But that's the most important tool that you have in the toolbox to help protect your purchasing power and help be prudent manager of the assets that you have fought hard and sacrificed to accumulate on the side so that they can provide income for you for the rest of your life. And ideally, hopefully, if something's left over, help shelter your heirs or those institutions that you want to leave that to after you're gone and you don't need them anymore.
Well said. By the way, I have another tier zero asset people should consider, cows. I consider my cows to be another tier zero asset. They just walk around getting fat, you know, take care of themselves. It's all fine. It's all good. It's all good. All right. With that is our time for today. So everybody who wants to, and I know a lot of you do, talk to Paul and or his team at Kiker Wealth Management, please go to Peak Financial Investing, fill out a simple form, and within 48 business hours, somebody from Paul's team will contact you, schedule the call, and you can get the process started. And so I hope you do that, and because it's really worthwhile whether or not you end up working with Paul and his team. Everybody says it's a worthwhile process. You get an initial call, a planning session, and then if it moves to that point, a recommendation session, and then if it moves further than that, you work together. But the planning and recommendation alone are very worth it. So please do that at peakfinancialinvesting.com. Hey, Paul, thanks for your time today.
Hey, it's my honor. Good to see you guys, and look forward to seeing you again. Very important stuff we're covering.
All the best with snow and Icemageddon, buddy. All the best.
Yes, I'm going to be carrying a chainsaw around in the back of my truck if I can get out without the ice. So hopefully we get the snow and no ice, but if we get the ice, at least we're prepared to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to be fun, but we'll deal with it.
Well, good luck with all that. And everybody else, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on the next episode of PeakFinancialInvesting.com's Finance You Show. Thank you very much. Until next time, bye-bye.